morning, fellow travelers. This is Peter Haig, co-host of On the Menu, a sort of radio program that goes out over the internet, all about food and travel and wine and wonderful things. And this morning's show kicks off with a guest who's been with us before, but she's such a wonderful person, and she gets up to such exciting adventures that we couldn't resist inviting back Patricia Raine, the Vanilla Queen. Vanilla Queen, Patricia Raine, good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm great. How are you doing today?
Well, we let our listeners in on to a little secret. We've been messing around a little bit with some new equipment, so you've been very patient while we tried to do that, and we're back to the conventional way of recording the program, but that's okay. Patricia, what have you been up to since the last time you talked to us?
A lot of different adventures. One of the most interesting components of what's going on at our end is the International Tropical Farmers Network. This was started after my online business at vanillic.com had been up for several years, and the prices of vanilla collapsed. As probably most of you who are listening remember, vanilla was extremely pricey in the early part of the 2000s, especially around 2003 and 4 and 5. Well, the prices for the farmers collapsed when a lot of farmers came in with fresh vanilla to the market. Also, the big corporations switched over to using imitations.
Yeah, I remember talking about that. So,
yeah.
I mean,
it was terrible.
If you like, that was a natural market reaction to the fact that vanilla prices got so high.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, on the backside of it, you got a much larger production of the good vanilla.
And everything collapsed for the farmers.
That's a terrible thing, yes.
I started a program on a Google group so that producers who could speak English well enough to be part of our core group and who had access somehow to the internet would be able to communicate with each other worldwide. And this was extremely exciting for the farmers. And they started sharing different experiences and problems they had. But, of course, the core problem always has been a market. What happened next was we decided to have meetings in Mexico this summer. The first of the meetings was to be with the women that are involved in the ITFN, which is our acronym. They were to get the action plan going for women's collectives so that we could start programs in Uganda, Mexico, and Haiti, with women who are in families that grow cacao or vanilla and have their own independent revenue streams. Then the next few days after we met, we're going to be devoted to getting the ITFN set up as a not-for-profit organization and plan our conference for Indonesia in 2008. Well, unfortunately, and this is a problem, of course, worldwide in the tropics.
Along came the weather, right?
Yes. Hurricane Dean slammed into Mexico and caused massive damage, not just to vanilla, but to all of the citrus, bananas, coconuts, tropical products that we get into the United States during the winter. And if that weren't enough, Tropical Lorenzo grew in a matter of hours in the Gulf of Mexico and slammed into the same town exactly a month later.
So it was just like a 1-2 punch. Huh?
It was unbelievable. So what I've been doing is raising funds for roofs. My feeling is that most people don't want to come to the United States as immigrant illegal workers. They would like to stay in their own countries and be with their families, but for a variety of reasons, there hasn't been work, and of course, tropical storms are one of the problems. So my feeling had been that if we could put a roof over a family's house, that they would be able to start rebuilding their lives and would be far more likely to remain in their homes rather than coming north.
There you go. So there's a special part of your website all about this.
Yes, right on the front page. People who are interested, you can make a donation as small as $5. A whole roof costs $270, which is awfully cheap, but it would make all the difference in a family who may be growing your lemons or limes or your vanilla or chocolate or coffee.
So you're stepping outside the boundaries of vanilla.com just because you think the cause is so important.
Well, I've been actually working with farmers who grow a variety of commodities. The ITFN was started with people whose primary crop has been vanilla, or at least one of their crops has been vanilla. But because commodities, especially tropical commodities, are so strongly affected by supply and demand and weather-related problems, most of the farmers need to grow more than one crop.
Yeah, I got you. Yes.
And so, you know, and my personal mission is to these farmers who are growing any of a number of tropical commodities, because the conditions under which they work and the problems they face are pretty much universal, depending on, you know, whether it's sugarcane or rice or bananas or whatever it is. And the whole point of what we're trying to do is to give especially the poorer farmers more autonomy, more personal power to be able to produce what is needed at a fair price to them. Whether it's fair trade or not, to me, is less important as long as I know they're getting a fair price. But to actually be certified fair trade is sometimes very complicated, and the same is true for organic. While most vanilla is grown organically anyway, the bigger issue is that the farmers cannot afford to get organic certification or fair trade certification. So I've created a new moniker for all of this called Eco-Humane, and that's what I sell. Products that have been grown sustainably, ecologically, and that the farmers have been given a humane price for what they grow.
Now, you're somewhat familiar with Madagascar, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Patricia, have you ever run across a group of people there that the company's called Malagasy, I think?
Yeah.
And do you know those people? We met them at the Fancy Food Show in New York, and they had a wonderful story to tell.
Yes, I know several of the people that are doing this. There are small groups now coming out of Madagascar. Madagascar has been a complicated country for a while.
Oh, yes, yeah, it is. It is a complicated country.
It's a very complicated country, but in terms of vanilla, it's also complicated because even though they grow the majority of the world's vanilla at this time, though vanilla started in the Americas, it's a true American food, the problem has been that the farmers are very isolated. They don't speak French, which is the second language of the country. They only speak Malagash. And they never see where their vanilla beans go or what happens to them. And so the majority of them, because they don't have electricity, they don't have telephones, they have absolutely no concept of how people are using this product they grow. And when they harvest it, it doesn't have an aroma. And since most of them don't cure and dry their own beans, as far as they know, it's being used for rubber tires.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's just fairly recently that there are a few groups who are coming into the world market who are directly representing farmers and are making that shift. And these are people that we're inviting into the ITFN to represent their groups through our larger core group.
Now, the people that we met in New York, I wish I'd brought the whole website with me, but if you Google Malagasy, just like the, I guess, the anglicized version of the local language there, I'm sure you'll find this group. They're doing something even more interesting. They decided that just producing crops like vanilla and cocoa and green peppercorns and things like that and shipping them overseas didn't add very much value in the economy at all. So they decided that instead of that, they would produce a finished product.
That's what we're trying to get farmers doing everywhere.
So the finished product is a fully manufactured in Madagascar chocolate bar.
Yes.
And
yes.
I just wondered if you had... we're familiar with this idea. They have an eco-sounding name for it. I wish I could recall what it was.
Yeah, I haven't tried them yet. I've heard that they're out, and I haven't had the opportunity to taste them. But I think this is exactly the type of thing that we're trying to do on an international level through our group, is to find products that the FDA will allow to come into the market that's been another issue.
Right. Well, I think these guys were they were obviously struggling with the U.S. They're all Brits. They're all from England. So I think that that England has a great appetite for chocolate bars anyway. So I think they probably.
And, well, you see, the other thing is now I've been working with a group who has also been producing chocolate. I think they're working together. A lot of these people are old Peace Corps workers who realized, you know, they didn't want to leave totally after they had done their tour of duty, that they wanted to do something that would make a difference. So they were talking about manufacturing vanilla extract in Madagascar. And what
rather than simply sending the beans.
Yes. The problem, of course, is that the extract weighs so much more proportionately, especially more than a chocolate bar, for instance. Then there are the problems with alcohol taxes and clearance with the FDA, and then there has to be a market. And so it's very complicated to try to figure out how we can best help the farmers without shooting ourselves in the foot. And this is part of what has happened with some of the commodities with organic and fair trade, where the concept is brilliant and it works for products such as, say, bananas, because bananas are probably the most eaten fruit in the United States and in many, many other countries. You know, it's simple. You can, you know, just peel it and eat it. And there are millions and millions of bananas that are sent in. Now, with coffee, you've got millions of tons of coffee beans being purchased yearly. With cacao, you've got millions of tons of cacao beans being sold. But with vanilla, you only have 2,300 tons.
All together.
And so trying to get small farmers who farm on 2 acres of land or 4 acres of land to be able to afford $5,000 to $6,000 to be certified organically.
Yes, yep. No,
it's impossible.
No, I see exactly what you mean.
Where, you know, I have always been very outspoken about finding ways to give fair prices to farmers. The other issue with organic and fair trade certification is that, let's say I'm working with a group that is fair trade and organic certified, and they sell to me. I have to pay a fee to be organic and certified
as well
in my facility.
Yes, yes.
I sell it to you, who are going to then sell it to somebody you know who's making the product. You have to be certified organic and fair trade, and then the end product has to be. So money is changing hands every step of the way. Now, how this impacts the end user can be found in cost. And although most of us are willing to pay a little more for a product that we know that the farmers have made a fair price for, a lot of the companies who are very small, myself included, cannot easily afford all the extra fees that are being taxed onto us in order to help the farmers. So instead, if I go to Mexico and I buy vanilla at $50 a kilo and it's also being sold fair traded at $50 a kilo, I'm selling the very same vanilla that hasn't perhaps gotten the fair trade market, you know, marketing or the organic marketing, but it's exactly the same vanilla. I can sell it for cheaper than they can if they go through the fair trade and certified route, and yet the farmer is still getting a fair price, and that's eco-humane.
So it's not that I don't want
to undercut the others. It's rather that I want to make sure the farmers get a fair price and the consumers will buy.
So the farmers get a fair price, but they also don't have to pay the costs associated with becoming certified.
Right. Most of the certification groups are actually done through an agency that is working directly with a collective of farmers. And in that environment, it works well. But if you're working with individual farmers, then, you know, it just can't be done. And I think this is something that's important, as, you know, because this is a fairly pioneering process. traditionally, tropical commodities have been bought and sold by a very small group of people under very controlled circumstances where they controlled the prices, the farmers took whatever they could get, and then, you know, were often really, really robbed. And so the whole concept of organic and fair trade was based on giving the farmers a greater profit into the market and also attempting to reduce the amount of pesticides that may be used on products. But with anything that's newly being tried, there invariably are places where it's going to break down. And so now we're in the process of needing to determine how can we fix what's broken without throwing the baby out.
Now, what's the future for vanilla?
What do you mean by the future?
Well, I mean it seems that this is such a wonderfully subtle product.
Vanilla does a lot of different things. If I understand where you're going with this, it is not only a classic flavor that we expect to taste in a lot of desserts, but it has the capacity of lifting and enhancing other flavors.
Can you give me some examples?
Savory foods. Let's say we're going to make a chicken dish that we want to have chipotle chili in. And so we're going to make, we can anticipate it's going to be a spicy dish. And we want that little bit of smoky sweetness of the chipotle in there, along with some of the heat that we could expect from the chili. If you add some vanilla extract or part of a bean, depending on how you're making your product, to that dish, the sweetness and smokiness of the chipotle will be enhanced. A little of the heat may be diminished, but the point of chili is not just the heat, but the complexity of the chili itself.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
that's what a lot of people lose.
Yes.
You know, they just say, make it hotter, make it hotter. Well, hot it doesn't always equate with full flavor.
No, it absolutely does. In fact, it really gets in the way. So what you're saying is that there's a subtlety that vanilla adds to savory dishes as well.
And it will bring up the flavor of that chipotle smokiness and sweetness, while at the same time softening a bit of the heat.
Now, can people find out ideas like this from your website?
Absolutely. We have a whole food section with recipes as well as chefs in residence who each bring at least 3 recipes to the page. So there are hundreds of recipes. And then we have a book, The Vanilla Chef, which I purposely self-published so that when we get our women's collectives going, the women can buy this book at a very, very reduced price and sell the book at full price so that they actually have a real revenue stream. They're not just selling some clever craft that costs the tourist a couple of dollars, or there are 3 vanilla beans or 8 vanilla beans or 10 vanilla beans that they're selling to the tourist. They can also sell the book for $15.95. that tells the tourist how to use their vanilla, and in the book will be a page on that particular collective. But for the time being, with the books being bought off my site, they can be bought for $13.95, and they give the reader a large spectrum of recipes as well as tips and ideas on how to use vanilla in ways that are outside the box.
Are there any particularly famous chefs who have honed in on vanilla?
Well, there are, you know, the first ones to really get on the bandwagon were the French, because of having vanilla grown in some of their colonial outposts, specifically Tahiti and Madagascar. And they, in Madagascar, while the Malagash people don't know how to use the vanilla, the French make fabulous dishes there using the French, frequently in cream sauces. In Tahiti, the local Tahitians love good food, and they started incorporating the vanilla into things like mahi-mahi dishes, banana poe, which is in my opinion, an acquired taste.
Okay, yeah.
Wasn't that tactful?
I think boy fits into one of those categories in my mind, too.
Yes, I think it's sort of like sauerkraut for someone coming from a country that's not used to sour salty.
Yeah.
But when I was in Tahiti, I started saying, you know, you should have this in your national dish, which is a wonderful ceviche, though they don't call it ceviche, and I'm not going to remember right off the top of my head what they do call it, but it's poisson cru is what
poisson
they call
cru, it. Yes, yeah, it's
yeah.
Raw, it's
and
raw,
poisson
it's raw
cru,
fish,
which
yes.
is raw fish,
yes.
has coconut milk and cilantro and onions and a little bit of pepper, and it is absolutely even better with a little bit of Tahitian vanilla, and I do have that recipe on my site.
There you go. Now all you do is find the mahi-mahi.
Yes. Well, sometimes you can find that in the fish market, and you don't have to just use mahi-mahi. You can use shrimp. You can use other fish that you really like and play with the dish. And if you don't want to have your fish raw, you can cook it slightly. You know, although it's not technically raw when it's been treated this way, because the lemon effectively, the enzymes break down the fish.
You should get after some of these chefs in New York who are doing all this wonderful crudo now.
Oh yes,
I'll have to talk to Michael Salakis from a wonderful restaurant in New York called Anthos, which John Mariani just christened Michael Chef of the Year in Esquire magazine.
Nice.
And we must ask him if he's thought of using vanilla as a flavor.
When you talk to him, please do, and tell him to call the Queen.
There you go.
I'd be happy to talk to him. I really get excited getting chefs excited. You know, that's a wonderful thing, because if we get the chefs excited, then we, the consumers, can enjoy it and get excited ourselves by seeing how they've used products in a unique way. Similarly to, you know, people didn't, except for mole, the Puebla mole, people typically were not putting chocolate into savory dishes. But it's wonderful in savory dishes if used properly.
Absolutely. Now, just before you go, it's listeners, they're not plowshares, they're cowshares.
Yes, cowshares.
Tell us quickly about cowshares before we sign off here.
I'm a member of the Global Women's Leadership Network and a graduate of the inaugural program of Women Leaders for the World, a program out of Santa Clara University where we train women to be able to do international projects of merit, what we call social entrepreneuring, where we're helping set up groups of women, usually, but not always just women, often men and women, to find ways to support themselves more effectively in developing countries. We started Cowshares to raise money for women from Africa to be able to come to the United States to be part of this training. It's not an inexpensive program, and so we need scholarship funds to help these women be able to then go back and make a significant difference in their countries of origin. So you can buy a cowshare for $25 or more and receive a wonderful certificate. It's a picture of a cow that a wonderful, I call her my niece, Ugandan woman was ready to sell to be able to pay her way to come to the United States for this program. Instead, we memorialized her cow on this wonderful coupon to be effectively the image of helping a woman get this training so that she can affect thousands of others.
Patricia, I don't know how you keep it up. I don't know how you have the energy and the creativity to come up with all these wonderful things, but do keep up the great work, and as you have something new going on about that you'd like on the menu to know about, you'll be sure to send us an email or give us a call.
Oh, I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, all of you who've listened today.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us. It's www.vanilla.com. Real easy. Patricia Rain is the brains behind this entire operation, and I hope today's discussion has just given you some idea of the kinds of things that Patricia knows about that you'll be able to find out about when you log on and become a part of the Vanilla Queens organization. Patricia, have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Peter.
And we'll take a break now.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Data security and speed can be what puts your business ahead of your competition. But cost is important too. You might be paying every month for bandwidth you don't use. Let's talk about your company's disaster recovery system. Is it as effective and secure as it could be? What are you paying for your T1 line? I'll bet we can offer you a better deal. We're ASP Station, a premier independent server co-location facility and high-speed internet access provider. Virtually unlimited bandwidth, co-location for your backup servers, off-site system backup, and secure access to your equipment 24/7. Check us out on the web at aspstation.net or call us at 412-661-6001. Easy number to remember. 412-661-6001. ASP Station, 412-661-6001.
Welcome back, listeners, to On the Menu Radio. Don't forget that you can email us at any time at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and you can check out many of the other things that we've collected for you at www.onthemenuradio.com. Next up, two very fascinating, larger-than-life personality guests, both of whom were recently in Pittsburgh, and I had the chance to catch up with them, and you can have the benefit of listening to what they had to say.
Crescent Dragon Wagon came all the way to Pittsburgh, so she had the opportunity to talk to On the Menu. That's not strictly correct, because she's here on a book tour, and she's here for Good Taste Pittsburgh tomorrow. But I caught up with her at a central meeting point in the city of Pittsburgh, because I really wanted to know how it was possible to write a book all about what seems like such a simple thing. Crescent?
Well, the Cornbread Gospels had a couple of starting points. One is that I always loved cornbread. My mother is a Southerner, and I grew up eating it. But the first time I really had my cornbread epiphany, I was living in Brooklyn as a teenager, and I was living in a commune, and little did I know that I was part of gentrification, and the home that I was in would become the stepping stone. But at that time, we were the only white people on the block. And we became friends with our neighbors. And one day, a lady named Viola, who was the boyfriend of Freddie, when we were leaving to go to get back to the land and to become self-sufficient, the sort of the roots of the sustainable agriculture and the idea of not being alienated from one's food. Anyway, we were going to go live in the country, and Freddie, our friend, heard that we were going to the Ozarks in Arkansas, would always say, "They gon' kill you in Arkansas." But they didn't kill us, and to send us off, Freddie and Viola made us dinner. And there was this fantastic cornbread that was baked in a skillet. And Viola had a very soft voice, she was kind of shy, and she told me how to make it. And that really, that the taste of that cornbread and the fact that it was made in the skillet really began my interest in that. And then over the years, I lived in the South for 33 years, and the part that it plays there. With my late husband, I had a very upscale, we called our style of cooking New Ozarks. We were in the Ozark Mountains. We used a lot of course, locally grown, fresh, seasonal.
But the story really goes back to the fact that corn was the first food in the United States of Native Americans, and then of the first people who came to settle here from Europe. So it's really absolutely fundamental to the American way of life.
That is completely true. Its history goes back 3,000 years before Christ was born. And teosinte, a wild grass on the Mexican highlands, some Native Americans in central Mexico began noticing this green on it, and very carefully selecting it over the years, they noticed the bigger grains, and you know, we don't know those people, they're lost in history. And so they developed this grain, which also, you know, they used it in trade, and from the southwest it moved north, and corn was very adaptable. So it could, strains of it could be grown in the Dakotas or in New England in cold, and there were huge yields, and it was delicious, and it was sacred. Many of their creation myths come out around corn. Corn is seen as either the mother or father, depending on the tribe. And then here come the occupiers, the colonists, and they come out of wheat culture. So from the Native American population to whom corn was sacred and survival but also reverence, we have these wheat culture arrivals who view corn as inferior wheat. And they're very hard-headed, and they keep trying to make corn behave like wheat, which of course it wasn't meant to do. It was meant to behave like corn. And so at first they were very condescending towards it. And they called it Indian or Injun rather than corn. Corn was just the name for grain itself. But then it began to become a badge of Americanism. So when their own children began to be born on this soil and raised on cornbread, it became the way that you entered into Americanism. And there's actually a piece of a letter from Ben Franklin in the book somewhere where he defends corn against defamation in a London newspaper. He says, you know, what a marvelous breadstuff it is, and that it is better than a Yorkshire muffin.
So this book is part history book too. It's the history of how corn got into the different parts of the country and how it was treated differently, and you have lots and lots of wonderful stories like the one you just told.
Well, it is that, but, you know, the thing that also drew me to writing about it was while it has these ancient roots and fascinating, really global stories that encompass the whole world in that way, it also encompasses the small world, which is most people, what are you working on? Well, I just finished a book about cornbread. Cornbread? I love cornbread! I heard that so many times, over and over, and, you know, and we have it as primal food, as tortillas. We have southern cornbread. We have northern cornbread. Southerners are very pugnacious about what real cornbread is. But of course, America's real, real cornbread is the corn tortilla. But in the South, they're very particular that it not get flour added to it, or very little, not have sugar added to it, or very, very little. And in the North, it's a bit less. It's more a specialty food. In the South, it was the daily bread for a long time. And then you have all the Southwestern influences floating in with chilies and, you know, at where you've chosen to meet me, Peter, I was wandering around and they have their menus posted for their holiday dinners. And just, I was noticing how many of them, they had a corn chowder on their Thanksgiving menu and their turkey was stuffed with cornbread sage dressing. And they had a wine tasting dinner, and they had South American dish that they said was served with humitas, which they describe as corn stew. And they being the hotel that we happen to be at, which the corn humitas that I have in my book are more like corn puddings with fresh corn ground in it. And it's really, I mean, not only in the sense that you know, corn syrup isn't everything, but it is really such an American food that has now been adopted by the world.
Now, the book isn't just about cornbread of different kinds. You have corn in a variety of different recipe formats as well. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I decided that bread counted as anything you could pick up. So I went from, you know, and I have a lot of the traditional breads, but I also have corn puddings. I have spoon breads, which are lovely souffles that are done with cooked cornmeal as a base. I decided not to put polenta in as such. My rule was it had to be pick-upable, just my own special rule. And I also got carried away with doing desserts based around cornmeal. I started with bread puddings based on, there's a chapter in there called Always Make a Second Batch or Deja Food. And so I started out getting intrigued with making an extra pan and drying out the crumbs for dressing or stuffing. And then I started playing with bread puddings. And then I really started playing with bread puddings. And then I wound up doing just a lovely lemon pound cake with that delicious little bit of grittiness in it from the cornmeal. And, I did some traditional recipes. Whenever possible, I went to the source. I learned how to make maki ki roti, Indian cornbread, from a Pakistani, the cab company, they worked together very well in London. It was a Pakistani Muslim and a Hindu Indian, and they worked together. No civil war there between the two of them. And he told me that in North India, they ate cornbread and greens, and I nearly fell over because that's when I was living in the South, and you know, the South proudly claims cornbread and beans, cornbread and greens, as well as cornbread and greens. So he taught me how to, I have still the book where I was making frantic notes in the back of a cab as he was describing this to me. And I also have a chapter in there, you know, as for that, for Mr. Pansir, that man, Pakistani cab driver, you know, it was incomprehensible to him to say maki ki roti without saying sog, or mustard greens, and to describe how he made that. I remember him saying from the front seat, glancing into the rear view, you're cutting it small, 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 small. And so I also have a chapter on gowis, beans, soups, spinach, and the book also is full of quotes that people say about cornbread because it has this huge part in the literature, particularly of the South, but not only of the South. So, you know, there was lots to draw on and season it with. But the final result of a cookbook is that when you sit down to dinner, what you put in your mouth tastes so good, you know, that you almost close your eyes for a second to still. You know how a lot of times it happens at dessert. I used to know to notice this at the restaurant. There's that moment when people take the first bite and there's just quiet. They're tasting.
How would you expect someone would use the book? I mean, it has more than 200 recipes, a wide variety. I mean, if you're sitting down to plan a meal, how do you expect people might go about that?
That's an interesting question, Peter, and I haven't really thought about it as such. You know, people are always saying, I always bring cornbread to potlucks, and people are saying, can you email me that recipe? Can you send me that recipe? But just one of the ways that you have a sense of satisfaction about a cookbook, and I just saw my first copy of this 10 days ago, I made one of the cornbread bread puddings using my own recipe. Usually in the kitchen I tend to cook sort of seat of the pans, but I made it with my own recipe, and it was a cornbread bread pudding that I had developed from the old southern habit of crumbling cornbread into buttermilk and eating it with a spoon as like comfort food. And a lot of the old time Ozark and Arkansas people did that, a lot of farm people did that. So I took making this cornbread bread pudding with buttermilk, and I think I had I had chopped apricots in it, and I made it the other night, and this really is good. This really is good. So I suspect people might start with the idea of, first of all, you know, it's called the Cornbread Gospels, and I always say the gospel is that whatever way you grew up eating it, that is the real cornbread. But there are many, many iterations of that. So I would hope that people would get fascinated by those other iterations. And I also have menus sprinkled throughout the book so that, you know, on things that you might not think of as cornbread, like there's a cornbread muffin that has fresh ginger and lemon and pears that I made for my partner when we were just first getting together. And there's a Valentine's Day brunch menu that accompanies it. So everything, I am not a dragon one note, even though the book is about one subject. It touches those subjects on a lot of different layers and levels, and also the way that it plays into menus on a lot of different levels.
Now, you're not exactly a one-trick pony. I think that it says you've written more than 40 cookbooks.
Well, I've written more than 40 books. They're not all cookbooks. I write for children as well. I've done a couple of novels. What I often say to people is I'm very fortunate that I love to write and that I'm reasonably good at it, because otherwise people would think I was a flake and a dilettante, but writing is the perfect career and calling for someone like me, because when I get pulled into something, my obsession or love affair of the moment, and you know, I just spent 6 years with Cord, and the more that I found out about it, the more there was. So I wound up doing a Cornbread Gospels website, and I've wound up doing a show called Until Just Moistened, a one-woman show, as I say, a one-woman show with crumbs that we'll be performing later on in the Clinton Presidential Library. And then I also, with my partner, we recently put a video up on YouTube, because one of the goofy little off-the-wall things about cornbread is that evidently domestic birds like parrots and macaws, that people call them companion birds is the politically correct way to refer to them, and that they're very, very picky eaters, and they won't eat their vitamins, and they won't eat their vegetables. So parrot owners fold lots of things into cornbread and feed it to their parrots, who then gobble it down. And I thought this was hilarious and wonderful. And even though I don't have parrots, there, to be a good parrot parent is very, very, very labor-intensive, but I've always admired them a lot. And so we did this very silly YouTube video, and if people were YouTube watchers, they can go there and type in cornbread and parrots, and the cornbread flutters ball will come up with me making cornbread and parrots eating it and music and lots of silliness.
Well, we're going to put the link up on onthemenuradio.com anyway, listeners, so you'll be able to find it there. You're not allowed to ask the question, where did Crescent Dragon Wagon get its name? But you can find the answer on the website. So, Crescent, why don't we conclude by you just giving the website for the Cornbread Gospels and also for your own other activities?
Well, come on by to cornbreadgospels.com, and there is a button that says, is that your real name? And you can click it and find out. I always tell people I'm happy to talk about my sex life or how much money I make. I'm just tired of talking about my name. Don't blame anybody for asking. But it is there for you to find out at cornbreadgospels.com, and there's a bunch of recipes there as well.
And you have a website for all your other activities too, I think.
Yes, I have dragonwagon.com, which I'm currently updating myself. That's why I was sending your listeners towards Cornbread Gospels, is, you know, whatever thing is your last one, that's the one you're most in love with. So at the moment, I'm in love with corn and cornbread, and I just redid that website, and oh, it's just brand spanking new, and so I'm very happy with it. But yes, there is also dragonwagon.com. I teach a writing workshop called Fearless Writing. Occasionally, I combine that with culinary travels. I have done truffle hunting in Italy with various people. We've done studied writing in the morning and gone truffle hunting in the afternoon. And so, basically, I think I kind of get to live a wonderful life, which in a way you do, because we were talking before we started about food people and just generous-spirited, interesting, because When you're interested in food, you're connected to life. No one eats alone.
Well, it was delightful to talk to you, and thank you so much for coming to meet me. And I think I'm going to get into cornbread.
Thank you, Peter.
And now we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Lots been written, and properly so, about the excitement surrounding the reopening of the Bedford Springs Hotel, now with an even more magnificent spa than ever before. And On the Menu had the opportunity to go there and experience it for ourselves and bring back interviews with some of the people who will make sure that the experience that you have there is a wonderful one.
Todd Gillespie is the Director of Sales and Marketing. He's an employee of Benchmark Hospitality Property Management Group, which, in fact, manages the Bedford Springs Hotel. Did I get all that right, John?
Yes, you did. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Now, you are a real pro. I read your credentials. You've been everywhere. Can you just run through some of your experiences?
Yes, I've been very fortunate. I've been in the hospitality industry for 15 years. I began my career at Lakeview Resort in Morgantown, West Virginia, and then spent a couple of years with Nemacolin and Woodlands Resort and Spa in Farmington, Pennsylvania, and then helped open up Rocky Gap Lodge and Golf Resort during their pre-opening and opening year outside of Cumberland, Maryland, and then was fortunate to represent the Greenbrier in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, and I was there for 4 years, and have been with Benchmark Hospitality for the last 6 years, most recently with Stonewall Resort, which is a beautiful four-diamond resort located right in the center of West Virginia.
Wow. Now, what dragged you from all of that to Bedford Springs?
Well, I was asked to come out and look at Bedford Springs in the fall of 2005, and I came out, and it was the first time that I'd really seen Bedford Springs. I'd heard about it, but had never visited it. And when I first saw it, it was closed for 20 years, and it was dilapidated. But when you saw it, you could still see the charm, and you could see the history, and you could see, from a hotelier's perspective, what a wonderful, beautiful, special place that it really is. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to be a part of something that meant so much to so many people, not just to our country, but also to our profession. And it's just a unique opportunity that I was just so excited to be a part of.
Well, I mean, it is very significant historically, and you've poured a lot of money into this. I mean, not you personally.
A lot of time.
But, I mean, do you expect to draw on a national level, an international level, or what?
Most definitely. We'll compete against the Greenbrier and the Homestead and Nemacolin Woodlands and the Hotel Hershey, but also against Boca Raton Resort and Spa and the Breakers and the Phoenician and the Arizona Biltmore. Our location is ideal. We're just, there's 20 million people within a 3-hour drive of Bedford Springs. We're just 2 hours from the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area, 90 minutes from Pittsburgh and Harrisburg. Philadelphia is just a short 3-hour drive away. And then it's the ease of arrival here. We're just 3 miles off of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, so it's pretty much an all interstate drive right to our doorstep.
We've been negligent. We didn't say exactly why this place started out, and it has to do with that bubbly stuff under the ground.
Oh, most definitely. Bedford Springs actually dates back hundreds and hundreds of years. There were three Native American tribes that frequented the 2,200-acre estate on which we sit. And they came here for the medicinal values of the seven natural springs that were found at Bedford Springs. And they shared this information with Dr. John Anderson, who purchased the property back in 1796.
Did he purchase it from?
Well, there were a couple other owners prior to that. However, the property certainly wasn't developed. But Dr. Anderson, he created one of the first spas in the United States, and guests began traveling west. Bedford was about the furthest point west that people would travel at that time. So Nathaniel Hawthorne and Aaron Burr and Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, those were some of our first guests here. And then there's been 10 United States presidents that have stayed at Bedford Springs, and Civil War generals used to bring their families here and get them comfortable and situated before they go off to war. So it's a wonderful history.
Well, you told me you knew a lot about this, and you really do.
Yeah.
Now, the obviously it grew around us. People were here, then they had to have places to stay, and then they had to have some place to eat. And then the more people came, the more they wanted social outlets and natural outlets. It's supposedly now a all-season resort. What are some of the activities here?
Oh, we're definitely a four-season resort. Bedford Springs is home to the Springs Eternal Spa, which will rival the finest spas in the United States. It's a 30,000 square foot spa.
That's new. That was
it's brand new. There were always the medicinal springs here that people would take the waters, as they would say. Now we have brought back the Bedford Baths. Actually, during our restoration process, we discovered an eighth spring, the Eternal Spring, and we had that water tested, and the information that came back to us was it's some of the most pure water you'll ever find in the world. So we were actually capturing that water. We diverted to the Springs Eternal Spa. There's the Bedford Baths, a bathing ritual that our guests will go through before they begin their manicures.
We're doing that tomorrow.
Oh,
can't wait.
Good for you. We should all be so lucky.
But this isn't sulfur in the springs. I read someplace where it was magnesium.
Well, we have eight now. There's the magnesium spring that the Native Americans would drink to help heal their stomach. And then there was the iron spring and the crystal spring and the black spring, which still to this day produces between 400,000 and 500,000 gallons of water a day. And then we have the limestone spring and the sulfur spring. We do have a sulfur spring here and the sweet spring, which was always the most powerful of the springs. But now that we're...
Todd Gillespie is the director of sales and marketing. He's an employee of Benchmark Hospitality Property Management Group, which in fact manages the Bedford Springs Hotel. Did I get all that right, Todd?
Yes, you did. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Now, you're a real pro. I read your credentials. You've been everywhere. Can you just run through some of your experiences?
Yes, I've been very fortunate. I've been in the hospitality industry for 15 years. I began my career at Lakeview Resort in Morgantown, West Virginia, and then spent a couple of years with Nemacolin Woodlands Resort and Spa in Farmington, Pennsylvania, and then helped open up Rocky Gap Lodge and Golf Resort during their pre-opening and opening year outside of Cumberland, Maryland, and then was fortunate to represent the Greenbrier in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, and I was there for 4 years, and have been with Benchmark Hospitality for the last 6 years, most recently with Stonewall Resort, which is a beautiful four-diamond resort located right in the center of West Virginia.
Wow. Now, what dragged you from all of that to Bedford Springs?
Well, I was asked to come out and look at Bedford Springs in the fall of 2005. And I came out, and it was the first time that I'd really seen Bedford Springs. I'd heard about it, but had never visited it. And when I first saw it, it was closed for 20 years, and it was dilapidated. But when you saw it, you could still see the charm, and you could see the history, and you could see, from a hotelier's perspective, what a wonderful, beautiful, special place that it really is. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to be a part of something that meant so much to so many people, not just to our country, but also to our profession. And it's just a unique opportunity that I was just so excited to be a part of.
Well, I mean, it is very significant historically, and you've poured a lot of money into this. I mean, not you personally.
A lot of time.
But, I mean, do you expect to draw on a national level, an international level, or what?
Most definitely. We'll compete against the Greenbrier and the Homestead and Nemacolin Woodlands and the Hotel Hershey, but also against Boca Raton Resort and Spa and the Breakers and the Phoenician and the Arizona Biltmore. Our location is ideal. There's 20 million people within a three-hour drive of Bedford Springs. We're just 2 hours from the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area, 90 minutes from Pittsburgh and Harrisburg. Philadelphia is just a short three-hour drive away. And then it's the ease of arrival here. We're just 3 miles off of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, so it's pretty much an all-interstate drive right to our doorstep.
We've been negligent. We didn't say exactly why this place started out, and it has to do with that bubbly stuff under the ground.
Oh, most definitely. Bedford Springs actually dates back hundreds and hundreds of years. There were three Native American tribes that frequented the 2,200 acre estate on which we sit, and they came here for the medicinal values of the seven natural springs that were found at Bedford Springs, and they shared this information with Dr. John Anderson, who purchased the property back in 1796.
Did he purchase it from?
Well, there were a couple other owners prior to that. However, the property certainly wasn't developed. But Dr. Anderson, he created one of the first spas in the United States, and guests began traveling west. Bedford was about the furthest point west that people would travel at that time. So Nathaniel Hawthorne and Aaron Burr and Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, those were some of our first guests here. And then there's been 10 United States presidents that have stayed at Bedford Springs, and Civil War generals used to bring their families here and get them comfortable and situated before they'd go off to war. So it is it's a wonderful history.
Well, you told me you knew a lot about this. You really do.
Yeah.
Now, obviously it grew around this. People were here, then they had to have places to stay, and then they had to have some place to eat. And then the more people came, the more they wanted social outlets and natural outlets. It's supposedly now a all-season resort. What are some of the activities here?
Oh, we're definitely a four-season resort. Bedford Springs is home to the Springs Eternal Spa, which will rival the finest spas in the United States. It's a 30,000 square foot spa.
That's new. That wasn't
It's brand new. There were always the medicinal springs here that people would take the waters, as they would say. Now we have brought back the Bedford Baths. Actually, during our restoration process, we discovered an eighth spring, the Eternal Spring, and we had that water tested, and the information that came back to us was some of the most pure water you'll ever find in the world. So we were actually capturing that water. We diverted to the Springs Eternal Spa. There's the Bedford Baths, a bathing ritual that our guests will go through before they begin their manicures.
We're doing that tomorrow.
Oh,
we can't wait.
Good for you. We should all be so lucky.
But this isn't sulfur in the springs. I read someplace where it was magnesium.
Well, we have eight now. There's the magnesium spring that the Native Americans would drink to help heal their stomach. And then there was the iron spring and the crystal spring and the black spring, which still to this day produces between 400,000 and 500,000 gallons of water a day. And then we have the limestone spring and the sulfur spring. We do have a sulfur spring here and the sweet spring, which was always the most powerful of the springs. But now that we're...
On the menu is the renovated and once again glorious Bedford Springs Hotel and Spa. And we're talking to Chef Conrad Meyer. Hello, Conrad.
Hello, Anne.
Now, you are executive chef, and it's a huge responsibility here. How many restaurants do you oversee, and what do they each do?
I will look at five restaurants. And to begin with, we have our fine dining room, 1796. And right there, attached to that, is the Frontier Tavern, our bar, where you can have drinks and food and play some pool, listen to some good music. And then we have our crystal room, where we're serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And we have our pool restaurant, which will be still working on renovating a little bit, getting some machinery in there to serve our guests better. And then we have also a Quesera Sera, which is our coffee shop.
Now, how do you handle all that?
Not by myself. I have many helpers helping me out, but... we get in fresh in the morning and we come in with good attitudes, and then we just walk a lot. The hotel is quite long, but I have some great chefs with me and some great cooks, and we make it happen on a daily basis.
Now, jump back to, I think that you're where you really are meant to be. You were born youngest?
Yeah, the youngest of 11.
Of 11. And you were born on a farm?
Yeah, we were born on the farm, and we grew up. Till my 12th year, I was living on the farm and helping out mom and dad milking the cows and harvesting the fields and getting used to things. And being the youngest of 11, so somebody had to take care of him. And then I was with mom all the time, and mom cooked. And she was a great cook, and she took care of things. And we were planting our own garden, so I was in charge of going out and picking out the white asparagus in the morning and picking the potatoes and getting things ready for the meal.
Well, now, it's not surprising then that all of your siblings, three of you, became professionals in the restaurant industry.
Yeah, three of them, and four of them were actually farmers, so it was always said that the four will raise the animals and we will cook them. So, and this is what happened. But it's very much was always about food. Family life was always in the kitchen. The living room was there to watch TV a little bit, but it was always like the family was gathering in the kitchen. We all came together and we cooking, like from a young age on. And mom taught us, and later on when she passed on and we were older, then actually the father took over. And he was a great chef as well, because he was always in the kitchen. So.
You were born and raised in a small village. Is it a small village in Germany?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. It's Mön, which is a small city where I was born, actually, and then we were living in Kogel, in a very, very small small village. And the sister actually came back after my mother passed away, and she had to take care of the young'uns, which was myself and two of my siblings. And she was a great chef as well. She was one of the professional chefs, and she stayed in the village and married actually a farmer and had children. And she took over the local restaurant, and the only thing she likes to do is to cook when she feels like it, and the word goes out, and her and her girlfriends come together. They're opening up the restaurant on a Sunday for lunch, and the whole village comes to eat, and she entertains people like that. So she's a lot of fun doing that. She never stepped away. She's farmer first, but then comes to cooking. And when you come to her kitchen on the farm, you'll be impressed what she can do.
Now, you, though, had some serious training also. I mean, you're not just a self-taught chef.
Oh, no. I started out an apprenticeship in 1978 in Lübeck in the Historischen Weinstuben, which is an old monastery, actually. And I learned the cooking there when I was 16 years old, and it was fantastic. It was a great operation, and the apprenticeship was 3 years long, and you had to go to school one day, and then you were supposed to have 2 days off, but you never had 2 days off because the restaurant was busy. So you learned the hard work right from the beginning, and it was fantastic. I'm very glad that I did it in these days, and I had a lot of fun doing it. And then after that, I started out working in the northern part of Germany, and then traveled actually to the southern part, and then from there to America, and saw some other places.
Yes, and you've been in the United States since 1978 and have worked in very many interesting places.
Yes, very much. Actually, I came in 86. In 86,
oh, 86. Why did I have in
78? I don't know. Maybe I was born that day. But we had the, I opened up the Vista International Hotel in Pittsburgh, and there was... in Pittsburgh, we opened up the Vista International Hotel, and I was in charge of the fine dining room. I think it's now a Western. Now it's a Western hotel. So we opened it up there, and I was in charge for the fine dining room, the Chef Saucier, and I was there for 1.5 years. And then I traveled to Canada. In Canada, Toronto, I was there for almost 2 years helping out.
Well, listeners, that's the end of our show for this week. Remember to join us again, same time, same place, next week.